optimal minimal.
At this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking.
Can I answer your personal question?
Now would have seen an appropriate time.
What if I did the opposite?
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
Me, Tim, Ferris, no.
This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I get asked all the time what I would take if I could only take one supplement. The answer is invariably Athletic Greens. I view it as all-in-one nutritional insurance. I recommended it, in fact, in the 4-Hour Body. This is more than 10 years ago, and I did not get paid to do so. With approximately 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense and comprehensive formula on the market. It has multivitamins, multi-mineral greens complex, probiotics and prebiotics for gut health, an immunity formula, digestive enzymes, adaptogens, and much more. I usually take it once or twice a day just to make sure I've covered my bases if I missed anything I'm not aware of. Of course, I focus on nutrient-dense meals to begin with. That's the basis. But Athletic Greens makes it easy to get a lot of nutrition when whole foods aren't readily available. From travel packets, I always have them in my bag when I'm zipping around. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving my audience a special offer on top of their all-in-one formula, which is a free vitamin D supplement and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription purchase. Many of us are deficient in vitamin D. I found that true for myself, which is usually produced in our bodies from sun exposure. So adding a vitamin D supplement to your daily routine is a great option for additional immune support. Support your immunity, gut health, and energy by visiting athleticgreens.com/TFS. You'll receive up to a year's supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your subscription. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/TFS, as in Tim Ferriss Show. athleticgreens.com/TFS.
This episode is brought to you by 5-Bullet Friday, my very own email newsletter. It's become one of the most popular email newsletters in the world with millions of subscribers, and it's super, super simple. It does not clog up your inbox. Every Friday, I send out 5 bullet points, super short, of the coolest things I've found that week, which sometimes includes apps, books, documentaries, supplements, gadgets, new self experiments, hacks, tricks, and all sorts of weird stuff that I dig up from around the world. You guys, podcast listeners and book readers, have asked me for something short and action-packed for a very long time, because after all, the podcast, the books, they can be quite long. And that's why I created 5 Bullet Friday. It's become one of my favorite things I do every week. It's free. It's always going to be free. And you can learn more at tim.blog/Friday. That's tim.blog/Friday. I get asked a lot how I meet guests for the podcast, some of the most amazing people I've ever interacted with. And little known fact, I've met probably 25% of them because they first subscribed to 5 Bullet Friday. So you'll be in good company. It's a lot of fun. 5 Bullet Friday is only available if you subscribe via email. I do not publish the content on the blog or anywhere else. Also, if I'm doing small in-person meetups, offering early access to startups, beta testing, special deals, or anything else that's very limited, I share it first with 5 Bullet Friday subscribers. So check it out, tim.blog/Friday. If you listen to this podcast, it's very likely that you'd dig it a lot. And you can, of course, easily subscribe anytime. So easy peasy. Again, that's tim.blog/Friday. And thanks for checking it out, if the spirit moves you.
BJ, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me here. It's very cool.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And we are sitting in Venice at my friend's house, Devin and his friend Travis Brewer, who's on American Ninja Warrior. So we have this incredible workout facility to the right, to my right, I guess, in the garage. But you do not, you work in Venice, but you live about an hour away.
I live over an hour away. So I've been getting into podcasts. I actually enjoy, I was telling you on the way in, I enjoy getting to see this other part of town, because mm-hmm. LA is really like several different cities, and I've never really known the West Side. So it's worth it to me, at least for now, to spend that hour. And listening to podcasts on the drive, it's really like an extra hour of reading a day.
Do you have any particular go-to podcasts at the moment?
I just started getting into yours. What else do I like? I love this podcast called The Great Debates. It's a comedy debate podcast. People really at the top of their intelligence, to Harvard friends of mine who are, you know, very well-educated, erudite comedy writers, just going at the most trivial and bizarre topics. One topic was, it would be cool if the Pope had an affair with Maura Tierney. And one of them took the side. The Catholic Church needs this sort of, you know, jolt and rebranding. And the other person saying, what's the point of an institution like this? You know, so...
So it's like Debate Club. I mean, it's...
Yeah. And then there's one, Intelligence Squared, which is sort of like the serious debate.
The serious version of that.
Yeah. The serious version of the comedy version of the serious thing. And that's been really interesting, too.
For those of you wondering what the whining is, it's not BJ. That's Molly, my dog. You mentioned two Harvard friends or fellow Harvard graduates. I have a question about Harvard. Yeah. And
you're a Princeton guy.
I went to the lesser known with the P, but it seems like there is a rich history of people coming to Hollywood from Harvard that you don't associate with, say, Yale. Or maybe so, but I haven't come across it as much, or other Ivies. Why is that? Because it seems to go back quite a ways. I mean, my family at one point knew Henry Beard, who then helped create National Lampoon.
Yeah.
And it just seems to go way, way back. And, I'd love to hear why that is. I really don't know.
The main correlation that I'm familiar with is the Harvard Lampoon, which is a really one of a kind comedy magazine that has its own spectacular castle building in the middle of prime real estate in Harvard Square. William Randolph Hearst funded this incredibly bizarre and exciting old building. And that has fostered a lot of intelligent people trying to get into this building / magazine / party house. And those people sort of train each other really, I wouldn't quite say viciously, but really rigorously about comedy. This joke doesn't progress. This joke is predictable. And it's very rare that you'll get 19-year-olds being hard on funny 18-year-olds year after year. And so I think that is a training system that is unlike just about anything else you'd be exposed to at that age. So that has led to a lot of people falling in love with and becoming very good at comedy writing, which is, you know, a real building block of entertainment that can be put to use. So a lot of people have traditionally graduated the Harvard Lampoon and gone on to write for The Simpsons or Saturday Night Live, or many, many other shows. And I think once you see graduates do that, you kind of think, oh, maybe I could do that. A big advantage, I think, of going to a fancy school, my dad, who did not go to a fancy school, but is a writer. A lot of people ask me, oh, did you have those advantages? Yes, of course, to an extent, but I find the biggest advantage is just not thinking that it's a crazy idea to try to be a comedy writer or to try to be a writer. Many people waste years working as a lawyer, working, you know, whatever they do that they think of as a more reasonable choice before they finally get the courage to write. So I think the huge advantage is if you have the talent, no matter where you are, if you believe that it's a reasonable choice of action, you're extremely fortunate. And that I think is a main advantage of going to Harvard. It doesn't seem crazy.
Right. I mean, you have these historical case studies of people who've done exactly what you might fantasize about doing. Right. And the rigor and the training is very interesting to me because I was the graphics editor at the Princeton Tiger. So, the satire magazine, cartoons, illustrations, that was my department. And I wanted that job partially because Jim Lee, who's sort of an iconic hero in the comic book world for me, had that previous post at Princeton. And I found a bunch of his drawings actually that did when he was shit-faced drunk after, going to a party on Nassau Street, but that's a separate story. The approach really was do something funny. And there wasn't a lot of structure. I mean, there was feedback if something sucked, obviously, or just didn't get any type of laughs whatsoever. But where did that structure develop? I mean, did people come back from, say, industry and help instill that in some way? Or did it just develop organically among the students?
The career path of it?
Oh, no, I mean hard on, say, underclassmen and looking at whether something progresses or not, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, I imagine that was simply, imitative of other, you know, rigorous extracurriculars at a school like that where, you know, the ski club or, you know, rowing or the Harvard Crimson newspaper, whatever, probably it's more inherited from that because a lot of people want to do these activities and you limit it to the people that you feel, and it's an incredibly subjective practice, but are the most talented at comedy writing. And so you put them through, well, can you do this? Can you do that? And you have to write a number of pieces in order to get on the staff. So I think that, you know, everything at a place like that is very competitive. And so this is just that same rigor applied to this incredibly subjective and often thought to be trivial field of comedy writing.
Did you?
And this does not lead to the best comedy writers by any means. It is just, that's one advantage. And the other advantage is that they believe they can do it. There are also huge disadvantages to coming from the Harvard Lampoon, which is a lack of sort of life experience or being in touch with what real people actually find funny or a sense of cockiness that is very antithetical to comedy. So there's definitely advantages and disadvantages to coming from a place like that.
Did you, at what point in your undergrad did you get involved with the Lampoon?
Well, I tried to get on from the very beginning. So I tried, you comp is the term for, you know, auditioning for it with your writing. So I tried three straight semesters. So I didn't get on until the middle of my sophomore year, but I wanted to be on from day one.
What do you think changed between your first attempts and getting accepted? How did you improve, or was it just that
I have no idea. I probably just improved because I was older and had been doing it longer, but it's also incredibly subjective. If I had not gotten on, I had vowed to never try again and decided those people didn't know what the fuck they were talking about. And then I did get on, and actually I did keep a healthy sense of this is not the be all end all, but it's so subjective.
How does, when you then did, writing after college, let's not hit fast forward too quickly, although I'm happy to jump around. The next step after graduating, what happened in the year after graduation?
Well, I have a sort of bizarre, sort of course of events, and what it has in common with everyone else is that everyone who gets a job in show business, they have a story that's not replicable. That's the one constant, ironically. So what happened was I was, one of my main extracurriculars at Harvard was I put on a show called The BJ Show with another kid named BJ, who was like a campus celebrity. He was like a reality show star before reality because he had stowed away on a plane to visit his family for Thanksgiving. This is before 9/11, so it wasn't quite as bad, but it's still, you know, it made the papers. Harvard student stows away on plane. He was the guy from the plane, you know, and so I saw an opportunity here, you know, to hitch my fame to his, and we put on this
to get attached,
show.
To get the plane guy attached to your
project. It's like, you know, I have the same name as the guy who was on the plane. You know, maybe we should do something together. So we put on the show, and I got, you know, some of my comedy friends, and we wrote this sort of, it was a variety show and parody of a variety show called The BJ Show. My senior year, I decided, let's invite Bob Saget to perform in this show because I had heard that he was a really filthy stand-up comic, which he is.
Now, what was the timing on this? This was probably...
This is 2001.
2001.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is before America's Funniest Home Videos.
This is after.
Oh, I'm sorry, after.
Yeah. So he's well-known as a, you know, family-friendly guy.
Right.
But I have heard rumors that he's filthy really stand-up. Filthy. So I think maybe we can book him. Maybe we can honor him at the Harvard Lampoon, and because he'll want the award, he'll come and do the show, which worked perfectly. I approached his management. I cold called his management and said, I'm calling from Harvard. We want to give Bob Saget an award and feature him in this show. And the show, you know, the proceeds went to charity. It wasn't a scam for me. I just thought it'd be a great show. By the way, that's a great thing. Always, if you don't care about the money, always give the money to charity because then everyone will do it. And often you just don't care about the money. You just want to put on something cool. So that's something I learned in college that I'll probably use again. If anytime I have like some cool scheme, like sure, keep them, like who cares? So I cold called his management. I asked my dad, how do you think I get in touch with Bob Saget? He said, call CAA. We're from like Boston. I don't know how he does. He said, look up, call 411, get CAA's number and ask CAA. They'll probably know. It's like, that's so smart. So I
one of the
CAA.
Big agencies in town.
Yeah.
For somebody.
So I call CAA. I say, do you guys represent Bob Saget? The receptionist says, no. I say, do you know who does? They say, I think Brillstein Gray. So I look up Brillstein Gray. I call Brillstein Gray. They do represent Bob Saget. They put me through to a guy. I explain my case. He says, send the stuff you're writing for Bob. I'll take a look. This guy later becomes my manager. So the manager, Michael Price, likes the material, recommends that Bob does it. Bob comes out and does the show, which is a very highly scripted show. There's a parody of Full House called The Lost Episode of Full House, in which Bob learns about sex from Uncle Jesse. very dirty, very funny. Anyway, so after the show, Bob and he had brought his show's creator. He was doing a new show that never really went anywhere, but it lasted one season. It was called Raising Dad. Oddly, it starred Kat Dennings and Brie Larson, who are now both very, very successful as well. But they hired me. They were like, oh, cool, a young, edgy writer, Harvard Lampoon, perfect. And they gave me a job on that staff while I was, you know, about to graduate. So I'm graduating.
Perfect setup.
Perfect in a way.
In a way.
I mean, too good to be true on a career level. But again, like I really had these, fantasies of being a great artist, a great, you know, filmmaker and, you know, a sort of a family WB show. I didn't want to move to LA. I knew that I shouldn't say no to this and I didn't say no to it, but it was, you know, I actually wanted to be like a starving artist, you know, and easy. I'm like, look, I'm from like a suburb. Starving artist means like borrow a little money and like live cheap. I have no real illusions, but I had mixed feelings. So it was sort of a dream come true and sort of career moving forward, but it was, you know, I was, I don't know.
What type of starving artist did you think you wanted to be when you were sophomore, junior?
I had read, this book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, about, independent film. And,
would you recommend it?
Highly recommend it. Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, about sort of filmmaking in the glory days of the '70s. And I wanted to be like that. And then there's a sequel about sort of the, Miramax, like the '90s Tarantino, Kevin Smith, that is also good. But I wanted to write like a screenplay that would like blow Hollywood apart. It was so edgy and innovative, et cetera. And then demand to direct it. And, you know, that's, I think anyone who saw Pulp Fiction as a teenager, that was their fantasy. So that was very much my fantasy. And, you know, in my privileged wannabe artist mind, this was a sellout move. But, you know, I knew it would be even more like privileged and like eye-rolly to turn it down. I mean, so it's an interesting paradox. I've noticed this. When I was young, I thought, oh, I'll never be a sellout. If anyone ever offers me something, sellout-y, I'll always say no. Then you realize there's a huge integrity pull towards doing the sellout thing because you think, who am I to turn down all this money for something that someone else's would, you know, struggle their whole lives to, et cetera, et cetera. And you actually feel very guilted towards at least doing what you would have considered a sellout thing. So it's an interesting paradox that I've observed with a lot of successful people. They get offered a really lame movie for a ton of money. And their thought isn't, fuck that, I'm an artist. Their thought is, God, who am I? I'd put my kids through college just to do a Christmas movie. Who am I to say no? It's very surprising. Right. I mean, it makes sense, but I'm surprised.
It does make sense, but it's an incentive of guilt as opposed to sort of an incentive of, yeah, of focus in a way. It's kind of like the Christmas story where it's like, there are starving kids in China, you know, and you're like, oh, okay, I'll eat this food that you put in front of me.
Right.
How did you then make decisions, or what happened after you were offered that gig on the...
I took it.
You took it.
You know, I took it, moved to LA, started writing for it. And I, you know, I looked around the room. I, it's interesting. I kept telling myself I'm making so much money, because for a kid at that age, it's so much money. But any job I've had since then, I made more money on The Office, for example, and I never thought I'm making so much money. So anytime I'm telling myself I'm making so much money, that's a warning sign that you're doing the wrong thing. Hmm. So I would tell myself that, because I gradually realized this isn't the life I want. I'd look around this writer's room and think, these are not the jobs I want. And I really, and I'm glad I did. I really had these dreams of doing something important and visible and exciting. And the only people in the room who I did aspire to be something like were Bob Saget, who would come by now and then in his fancy car and cool sunglasses and tell 10 jokes and leave, and get to be the star of the show. And Jonathan Katz, who created the show and had previously created Dr. Katz on Comedy Central.
Oh, sure.
Really cool show.
Oh, yeah. I know Dr.
And he
Katz.
Also came by now and then, gave some words of wisdom and jokes and then left and was also celebrated for his own voice. And I thought, well, those are the guys I want to be. And they were both stand-ups. So I thought, I had never thought of doing stand-up before then, but I realized, well, how insurmountable is this? Being a stand-up is writing a joke and then saying the joke. And that is what I'm doing in this writer's room. I write a joke. I say it out loud to see if it goes in the script. I guess I could try that and try to be like them. And so as the show was winding down, I signed up for open mics around LA and I would start, you know, saying one-liners into a microphone, and I was kind of doing stand-up comedy.
What was the, do you remember any of your early bits when you would get up?
Yeah, well, the first time was a real disaster, and one of my most important pieces of advice to anyone doing stand-up is, if you're really going to try stand-up, book your whole week of shows, your whole first week, in advance.
So you can't quit.
So you can't quit. Because I got up all this courage to do my first show. It was at a youth hostel, the Hollywood Youth Hostel. It was October 10th, 2001. So less than a month after 9/11. All my jokes were about 9/11. And I was not a good comic. And the crowd didn't speak much English. So, I followed a guy who killed. He did an impression of Robert De Niro taking a dump. And I have to say, it was great. It was a great impression, and you didn't need to know English. And it was completely the opposite of what I was doing. And, so I did this bit. It was horrible. And the host said after me to try to, you know, keep the show going, all he could muster for me was, takes a lot of courage to get up on this stage. And after that, I did not get on stage for 3 months. I had to work up the courage all over again because it had been such a disaster. And that time I was like, you know what? Tuesday I'm going to this coffee shop. Wednesday I'm going to this bar, you know, all these open mics. And, you know, the first night back I did pretty well. And the second night I didn't do well. But you can't make each night a referendum on whether or not you should be doing it. You just have to do a bunch.
And how did your approach change between that first bomb and the second sort of collection of attempts?
It was really, it was exactly that. It was the idea that, that I'm gonna really do this night after night, and I will evolve the act. And, you know, I was really bad for a while. But, you know, let's say you do 20 jokes and 3 of them get pity laughs. Well, those are the 3 you keep. And then after a while, one of them always does well. Well, that's your opener. Mm-hmm. And now 2 of them do well. Well, now you have a closer. And you sense, oh, okay, when I do this kind of joke, it does well. And, you know, it evolves that way.
And what did your parents do? You mentioned your dad wrote. He wrote some memoirs, or ghost wrote some memoirs for some big people, right?
Yep.
I mean, what are some sample?
The biggest one he did was Lee Iacocca. Mm-hmm. The biggest and first one he did. He also did the memoirs of Nancy Reagan, of Tip O'Neill, Magic Johnson, which was very exciting for me. He worked with Tim Russert on 2 books and George Stephanopoulos. So a lot of political people on both sides of the spectrum, and a lot of just eclectic business leaders, you know, various people.
What did your mom do?
My mom is a teacher now. Mm-hmm. She's done a bunch of things though. She's also kind of an eclectic career.
What did they think of your move to startups, that comes a little later. Stand up, similar sounding word. How'd they feel about that? What were the conversations like?
Yeah, I think they thought I wasn't very good. You know, my dad also is the co-editor of a couple humor books that are very good. The Big Book of Jewish Humor and the Big Book of New American Humor. And my family, like, comedy's a big deal to us. Like, they watch Seinfeld every night. Seinfeld and Key and Peele are the only things my parents watch, which I think is very good taste. So, you know, I think they kind of just, they definitely supported me writing. You know, I'd studied literature at Harvard. You know, my dad's a writer. There was nothing, again, huge advantage for me that my parents thought writing was like a good, a solid job, you know? And then stand-up was where they were like, ugh, like, okay, get it out of your system. This is not you, but whatever. You know, they never said this to me, but yeah, in retrospect, it's like, it's the same thing on stage when the audience is laughing and then you say something off the cuff and you get a huge laugh and you realize, oh, they weren't even laughing before. That my parents were like supportive. And then they really supported something different. And you're like, okay, so you were not, okay, you were just being polite. Fair enough.
And, so that was the sort of BG.
But they were slow, you know, they're supportive people. They came around and, you know, they supported The Office, you know, and
so when did what happened between that startup? I really want to say startup.
That's just
this is why I'm taking a break from startups, because I'm just like completely brainwashed. The you took a from that's first.
If you title this interview from stand up to startup,
I could. Yeah, that could be your memoir.
That could be. I'll call my dad right now.
From that point to The Office, what happened between those?
From that point to The Office, well, Raising Dad got canceled. Mm-hmm. I continued doing stand-up. I ran out of all the money that I had saved on my big money year in about, you know, a year and a half, 2 years of doing open mics and, you know, gradually getting better to the point where at the end of sort of after a year and a half, which is a long time when you are a kid from the suburbs.
It's a long time.
It's a long time, but compared to most stand-ups, you know, I got very lucky, of course, but it did feel like a very long time because I had been working. After about a year and a half, I got decent, definitely decent at stand-up, and I was starting to get booked at respected alternative rooms, at the Improv. And, you know, there's a lot of people in Hollywood that are always looking for anyone half promising to sign or to put on showcases. And I was becoming that comic that people would say, oh, there's a new guy. He's pretty good. You know, that kind of guy. And at the end of that, the end of that sort of 2 year stretch, a lot of things kind of happened at once. I got cast on the show Punk'd.
Sure.
I replaced Dax Shepard as the new guy, which I thought that's what I'll be famous for the rest of my life. I'm the guy from Punk'd. So I did pranks on Hilary Duff and Usher and people like that. Incredibly fun. And I got booked on Conan. I got booked on Comedy Central.
Was the Usher prank? I have a vague memory of this. Was this when his brother was set up to steal jewelry? Yep.
And then I tell him.
Usher handled that so well, I thought.
He was great. And then I tell Usher, you know, we can let this go if you record a radio ad for our store and do this rap that I wrote. They wrote a really funny rap, and I have to rap this to Usher. It was so hard to keep a straight face. And one of the brilliant touches the writers have put in is that in the rap, Usher refers to himself as Ice. And then I apologize that we originally wrote this for Vanilla Ice, who passed. So I got to do really funny, clever things. And around this time, I was on a showcase. Stand-up showcase for a network. And, you know, now I'd booked Punk'd and stuff like that. And that's when Greg Daniels, who was creating The American Office, saw me and thought, he was already looking for people that could write and act. And my jokes were very clearly like, you know, clever writing. They weren't like a raw personality or anything. So he thought, oh, maybe you can do, and I had a writing job. Maybe you could be a writer actor, which at the time was, it was a very experimental idea.
Yeah. I was going to ask you why he was looking for that.
Because he had worked at Saturday Night Live and he had a good experience where there it was a small gang of people who were kind of writing their own things. And also the British Office had been a small, you know, Ricky Gervais had written so much of it. So he was totally right. Let's not have a corporate feeling show with a writing staff and a cast. Let's cast kind of funny people who can kind of do it as a little unit.
And what was the very beginning of The Office like for you?
The beginning of The Office was very exciting, creatively especially, because it was not thought to be a show that, this is now I got to feel like that starving artist, like, you know, the actual integrity. This was not considered a show with any chance for success. It was a very drab, there's no laugh track, there's no colors, it's bleak, it's not a pretty cast, it's the jokes are very slow and dry, and it's a remake of a British show that, you know, NBC had a track record of disastrous remakes. So it was a 6-episode mid-season order. It was just a pilot order. And then we squeaked into 6 episodes. So the beginning was, but it was the people working on it were brilliant. Steve Carell's improvisations and Greg Daniels' sort of joke pitches and story outlines. And, pretty soon this very lean writing staff of Mindy Kaling and Paul Lieberstein, who played Toby on the show, and a bunch of other, Larry Wilmore, who now hosts The Nightly Show on Comedy Central, real, real lean group. And, so creatively it was extremely exciting. And then it was bizarre when it became successful, because we had come to think of it as the show that for the rest of our lives, we'd meet one or two comedy fans who were like, that's a classic. That's what we're going for like Mr. Show, mm-hmm. like cult status.
And when did you feel the tipping point? Or was there a particular event or moment or time when you're like, holy shit, this thing is actually going to be successful?
The beginning of the second season, it was around December, I think. So we'd been out for like over a year, but only a few episodes. And they moved us from... Two things happened. They moved us from Tuesday to Thursday, which I felt was very important, because now, the night you're on doesn't matter so much in the DVR era. But back then, my theory was that you wouldn't want to watch a show about an office at the beginning of your work week. funny on Tuesday.
Sounds like a fair assumption.
It's funny on Thursday. It's almost over. So there was that. And then the big thing was that the Apple iTunes store process began. And we, because our cult audience was very young and tech savvy, they made us a very big hit on the iTunes store, even though we were not a hit on NBC. And then people were walking around with like video iPods with The Office on it, and they were sending each other, links to download it and stuff. And so it was really one of the first shows to be a hit, like an online hit in that way. And that really was this viral, proto viral way the word spread about the show.
And so I have to ask a question that I've always wanted to ask somebody involved with The Office, because I have no idea how this came to pass. But a fan sent me a link to a clip at one point. The 4-hour work week came up in an episode of The Office where there's this big debate going on amongst everyone. And someone says, "What do you mean? I sent you an email." Pointing to Daryl, and Daryl says, "I don't check email until 12 noon.
Yeah.
4-hour work week." And then it zooms out of his face. Do you have any idea how that happened?
I
mean, it's a very specific question.
I was in the room when that was pitched. I don't remember whose it was. It was just, I thank you for being part of that joke. Working backwards from what we must have meant, it was just funny. Like, every little thing is going wrong, for Michael in this episode.
It was really hilarious and really made my week. That was
awesome.
It was very very surprised to come across it. So The Office, what are some lessons learned through your experience at The Office? I mean, what did you get better at, and why?
Lessons learned.
And we could talk about, you could have a particular person in mind if that helps.
Yeah. Well, one lesson that I learned from that, as well as from stand up, was that you really never know how something's going to play until you test it. Scenes that felt like they were just airtight winner hilarious scenes in the writer's room sometimes just would not work on set. And you had to learn to not be angry at it for not working. You had to learn to listen to the audience. And that's a major, major lesson. There's no one smarter than the audience.
And this is actually it was filmed in front of a live audience?
No, but there's, there's
that's,
a crew.
That's where,
but you
okay,
just feel
just,
it.
You just you feel do, it. You if it's flat,
read.
It's flat.
First, you do a table read of each episode. So you have a big room of people laughing or not laughing. And then when you take it down, if it's like a rewrite scene or something, Steve Carell says it and you're just there, even just you and the cameraman, like you're smiling or you're not.
Right.
Or then you edit it and it works or it doesn't. And that was, I think, a humbling lesson for someone who thought of himself as, a real writer. Because writing is really, it's just a guess. And, there's no there's no penalty for doing your homework. So if you want to test your stand-up at 1,000 rooms before you do it on TV, or if you want to test the stuff you're writing for the office in as many groups as you can, do it. Because you're not smarter than the audience. It's for the audience.
Would you test your material you're working on for the office in other environments?
In like little rooms, yeah. Everyone had their own office. So like, you know, Mindy and I would like read scenes out loud and, you know, just see if they sounded right. And right. Stuff like that.
You either see someone smile or not.
I yeah, mean, yeah.
What about Steve Carell? Did you observe anything particular?
Oh, well, I learned something from him, which was one time I, you know, wrote a bunch of jokes because the scene wasn't working. And I was the guy in charge of, you know, bringing alts, as we call them, you know, other versions. So I'd bring alts to the set, and he looked at all of them and he said, I don't know, these just feel like jokes to me. And I was like, well, yeah, they're jokes. That's what I do. That's what we do. But for him, comedy had to come from, comedy was a byproduct of authenticity. I would compare it to the difference between a kid who knows he's cute and a kid who doesn't. A kid who knows he's cute is not cute. A kid who just says something without realizing cute is hilarious. And that's what he wanted the office to feel like. Like, these people don't even know how funny they are. So that was important. I'm sure I'll come up with a lot more lessons because I learned more on that than anything.
Well, we could,
I can talk about the writing process that
I would love for you to write about. Yeah, I'd love for you to talk about that.
Well, the way that we would start a season, and I've adapted this to many things I've done since, we'd start with what we would call a blue sky period, which was my favorite part of every year. For 2, 3, 4 weeks sometimes, if we had long time, every single day in the writer's room was just, what if? There's no penalty. There's no, maybe we can't. There's no, but this one conflicts with that one. What if Dwight goes to the moon? What if Jim and Pam get divorced? What, you know, just every idea is valid for like, for a while. That was just an amazing period. And then
how long would that last?
That would last, if we didn't have much time, for, because we had different pre-production schedules, between 2 weeks and 4 weeks.
That's a decent stretch of time.
Yeah.
And was there structure to the what ifs? Like, was there somebody on a whiteboard taking down the favorites?
Yeah, a little bit, but it was sort of improvised day to day. Like, the showrunner would say, you know, all right, we don't have anything for Dwight. Or like, how about everyone split up and come up with 10 ideas for Ryan? Or, you know, let's come up with more ensemble stories. You know, there would be sort of a leadership that way. It wasn't just all sitting around. But
what is an ensemble story? I feel like I know what both really, words mean separately, but I don't.
The whole cast is involved in one thing rather than A story, B story. So that was incredible. And it really was creatively important. And I try to replicate that in everything I do, just not shut down any ideas for a period.
Just generate and not edit.
Yeah. And then the best ideas will fuel you past the problems. After a few weeks of blue sky, we would love some ideas so much. It would be obvious what the best, let's say we were going to start with 6 stories, right? It was obvious what the best 15 were. And then we'd start talking more seriously. And then we'd look, which ones do our love for the story carry us through the inevitable? Well, how could Dwight be here if he's also there? And, you know, stuff like that. But finding the love first and then letting that carry you through the problem.
Could you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, you find what you love about an episode, or in other things I've done, a story idea or a stand-up bit. You know, you got to just indulge, develop what you love about it, so that when you then come up with, oh, but then we couldn't show this on TV, or it is kind of contrived, or whatever it is, you'll love it so much that you will have the inspiration to fix it.
Got it. So you're developing the piece that you've fallen in love with enough so that you can handle all the inevitable.
Yeah.
Fixer-upper issues.
I do that with my other writing too. I always start with what I love. And if I'm stuck on a story, and I approach it the next day, I never go to the hard part first. Some writers probably do. I go to what's the one thing I'm proud of in the story?
Could you give an example?
Not off the top of my head, but you know, like there might just
or
be
hypothetical,
there might just be a joke or a phrase or a beautiful line that I'm proud of that I'm just so certain everyone's going to think I'm brilliant. And so I start at that and I get excited, and then I want everything else to live up to that rather than start at the problem. That's a personal thing. I am very motivated by positive thinking.
Were there any other
positive ego? You know, use your own ego to fuel yourself rather than be an obstacle.
What other approaches do you take in your work life or personal life to maintain positivity or use positivity?
I consider being in a good mood the most important part of my creative process. So right or wrong, I personally don't get up early unless I'm awake early, or I have somewhere to be. I know I've read the book we talked about, Daily Rituals, mm-hmm. which I love.
Yeah, Mason Curry, great book.
I'm demoralized by how many great people start their day very early.
Were you encouraged or demoralized by how many of them were drug addicts?
was encouraged.
It's like 90% used methamphetamine.
Methamphetamine, right. But you know, this venti Starbucks in front of me, like who's to say that doesn't have the same stimulation that they used back then? So, you know, I try to go to bed early and wake up early, but if I need to sleep late or take a walk in the morning or whatever, I find that being in a good mood for creative work is worth the hours that it takes to get in a good mood. So often when I was writing my books, I would, you know, someone would check in, send me a text at like 11:30, like, how are you doing? You know, what's up? And I'd say powering up. I just feel, you know, the first few hours are just getting into a good mood until I think, all right. You know, I have an idea I'm excited about, or I have so much self-loathing and caffeine that I'm like, got to do something.
The self-loathing plus caffeine is a hell of a thing. One of my friends, Kelly Starrett, who's a very well-known athletic trainer, calls it cup of fear. So you take the self-loathing and then you drink a cup of fear.
I'll tell you my number one, while we're on this, my number one creative productivity advice to anyone. Anyone, if it works for you, I carry around a notebook. And if I don't have a little notebook, I have my phone, you know, but I really divide my creative work into two distinct phases, which is the idea phase and the execution phase. And I do not let either interrupt the other. That's the best way to say it. So if I'm taking a walk or I'm having a drink with a friend and just some funny idea comes up, something that makes me smile or some other impulse, I write it down, and I never judge, well, what would you do with this idea or how would you end that joke? Never. I just have this notebook and I feel like the richest man in the world in terms of ideas. Just fill it up, feel great, always, never question it. Then on a separate day, I sit down, you know, 9 or 10 a.m. with a big cup of coffee at my desk, go through the notebook, and I do my best with every idea in the book. So I never am intimidated.
When you say do your best, you're developing each one on a separate piece of paper or something like that?
Yeah, on my computer usually. Mm-hmm. Or continue an idea on the computer that I left off the previous day. But first I'll check my notebook. Oh, did I have any ideas for solutions or whatever? So the idea, to me, everything is idea and execution. And if you separate idea and execution, you don't put too much pressure on either of them.
I was reading an article by Isaac Asimov about sort of creativity in groups versus solo creativity, and very similar conclusion that he came to, just keeping them separate. Now, when you do you have a particular type of notebook, particular type of pen that you like?
Yeah, I use the Moleskine Cahier, is that how you say it?
I have no idea.
You can buy them, Cahier. Mm. You can go on Amazon and buy these three packs. So they're much thinner than the typical Moleskine notebook. So you can keep them in your pocket easier and you finish them so you feel more productive.
You feel like you've accomplished something.
Fill them up in a couple of weeks. And then I have a huge box of them. But I use that and I use the Uniball Vision pen.
And
generally.
How do you... Do you date them? How do you keep track of these
notebooks?
What I do,
I order different colors and mix up the colors that I order, and then I buy on Amazon these huge batches of stickers, shape stickers that teachers use to put on, you know, reports and stuff, like stars and circles and blue rectangles and stuff. And every time I start a new notebook, I write my phone number in the first page in case anyone finds it.
Super important, yeah.
Yep. And then I put a sticker in the top left corner of the book. That lets me know which one I'm on currently. And then I have a red box for, I have a white box for untranscribed notebooks, because then I transcribe them on my computer, and a red box for transcribed notebooks. and I don't date them. And I always tell myself I should date them. This is crazy because when I go through the white box, you know, I'm jumping around 6 months ago, 4 months ago, you know, I'm not going in order, but I guess just, I'm not going to question it because something about the creative process, I just don't want to date them. I just don't know.
Interesting. What, I mean, maybe that would create some bias against older material. I mean, for the same reason that I take dates on my blog posts and I moved them from the top to as a small italicized line at the bottom and my traffic jumped like 20-30% because people are no longer biased against older material.
That's very interesting. That's something on the list up too. We keep an eye on.
And we're going to talk a lot about lists.
Not trying to rush you.
No. We're going to get there. I love the red box and white box. When you develop these or do your best with them, as you said, on the computer, are you doing this in a particular app or program, or is it limited to whatever your current focus is, say a book or a screenplay or film?
I use Microsoft Word. Mm-hmm. Same reason my dad used WordStar. It's just what I learned and got in the habit of. And I use Final Draft for screenplays because everyone does. Mm-hmm. I would like, I know there's other software out there. I would like something that kind of combines the two because often I would like to kind of write a paragraph and then kind of throw in dialogue easily. But, it's not worth it to me to investigate and switch.
Yeah. There's a tool that I've used for my last few books that I found extremely helpful. It's not as focused on screenwriting as, say, Final Draft, although people do use it for that. Called Scrivener. I don't know if you've ever seen this.
Yeah, I've heard of it, yeah.
I've used it for my last two books. I found it extremely helpful for that format. I think it's mostly used by playwrights, I want to say, but there are screenwriters who use it.
Blake Ross, I was going to mention, who invented Firefox.
Yeah.
He's an investor in the List app, and I've been trying to get him for years to develop with me a screenplay writing software because he's actually a terrific writer. And he wrote the Silicon Valley spec script that he put on Twitter, which is such a tech way to get your spec out there. But it was great. And, I think he would be the guy to crack it because he's the writer and also the software developer. I think he'd
where do, like, is he based? Is he still in the Bay Area or is he? Yeah. I need to actually spend some time with him at some point. He was very, very kind, when I think it was 2007, gave me a quote for the 4-hour work week. And I feel very indebted to him. So
he's awesome.
So if you're hearing this, thank you so much. I really owe you a coffee and dinner and a bottle of wine and probably more. Yeah. How do you think of yourself? I mean, I guess it depends on perhaps what project you're working on, but which of these many activities and artistic projects, crafts that you've attempted, do you most identify with?
Writer. Yeah.
Any particular type or is it just across the board writer?
Probably comedy writer, to be honest, for two reasons. One is just it's the identity I come from. I think it was Woody Allen who said, I do these different things, but if you woke me up and shook me in the middle of the night and said, what are you? I'd say writer. I definitely feel like that.
That's a good, I should rephrase my question to mimic Woody Allen's wording.
Everyone that. Yeah. If someone woke you up in the middle of the night and shook you and said, what's your job? What would you say? You know, or I guess the simpler way is what do you put on your passport or your customs declaration? I always put writer. But I think that everything I do is sort of a version of writing. Even if I'm acting, I'm sort of writing the way that I think this character would act. Do you know what I mean?
Of course.
Or if I have an idea, I really feel like, you know, idea and execution, that to me is writing.
If you were teaching freshman seminar at Harvard on comedy writing, mm-hmm. what would the curriculum look like?
Oh, great, great question. Well, PJ O'Rourke, who was one of the big National Lampoon editors, said that if he taught writing...
Confederacy of Dunces, did he write that? No. Am I making that up?
But he might have written the introduction to it or something.
All right.
So he said that if he ever taught English, he would assign parodies, because that's when you really learn something, is to parody it. So I would probably assign parodies of literature. I would...
Are there any particular parodies that...
Just sort of whatever you're studying in your other classes, mm-hmm. parody that.
I see.
And it really, I think, would open you up. I think mischief is just so important in comedy. It's really, there's just something like, am I really allowed to say that? You know, that's just the cool thing. Am I really allowed to hear that? I could pontificate. I know a couple things that I feel I have discovered about comedy. One is that first of all, the most important thing is it is sort of it's like sex in that it's about whether the other person is enjoying it or not, or you're enjoying it. You know, like you could say, do this and that. And then if neither of you has a good time, you couldn't insist to me like, but I had good sex. No, you didn't. Like that, I gave you my best advice, like touch her here and take your time and whisper this. Like I could do that, but you'll know if it's good sex or not. These are just tips. Like it's a physical reaction that you're going for. So there's that, you know, whatever you teach, it's like, hey, you'll feel it. Mm-hmm. You'll feel it. Or you'll hear it. You'll know. Mm-hmm. So do it a lot and, you know, probably, you know, don't take this class too seriously. One thing I've definitely learned about comedy, I don't know how it applies, maybe it applies to editing more than just to writing or finding what's good comedy. But I believe that a good comedy operates the exact same way a good mystery operates, which is the punchline should be something that was right in front of your face the whole time and you never would have put your finger on it.
It's like the red doorknobs in The Sixth Sense.
Red doorknob. Yeah, exactly. Of course. He was dead the whole time. You know, like, how did I not get that? That excitement, that elation, or like, it was the butler, it was the narrator, you know, whatever it was. That's the best comedy. When someone points out something, you're like, oh my God, that was so obvious. I never would have gotten it. Another thing is that observations are really the currency of comedy. Anything you do, if you observe something that touches a chord with somebody and that has not been expressed, right? You can turn that into a movie. You can turn that into a plot. You can turn that into a one-liner. But anytime you observe something that a good new observation, that's what fuels 99% of comedy. And the other 1% is just people falling down or whatever.
And are there any particular comics or comedy writers who are very good in your mind at the red doorknob effect? So hitting you with punchlines that have kind of been there all along.
Uh-huh.
But they do a good
Aziz Ansari has a bit about marriage that I find brilliant. I think it was one or two specials ago on Netflix where he's like, if we invented marriage now, if no one had heard of marriage and you proposed it to a girl, you would freak her out beyond belief. You know, I want a vow that will never, like, ever sleep with anyone else. And I want, like, rings on our fingers to symbolize it. And I want a priest to be there and everyone we've ever met. And there'll be a ceremony. It'll be in the newspaper. You know, that is so funny to me because it's completely true. Never would have noticed it. Louis C.K. is brilliant at pointing the stuff out, saying things that is kind of how you felt, but you never would have thought of it. But even, you know, an abstract one-liner comic like Zach Galifianakis, who I tried to see whenever I could when I moved to LA, you know, even those are like, right, that phrase could mean that, or why?
Sure.
You know, even that is an observation. Even
that's
just
true
about language.
That's true. Right. Like 24-hour banking. Who has time for that? The Stephen Wright kind of approach.
It's like, right. You could look at it that way.
You know who's really, really good at that is, now that I'm getting sort of a finer feel for what you meant is, perhaps the majority of really good stand-up comics are good at this. I don't know, but, why am I blank? Dimitri Martin.
Oh, yeah.
Dimitri Martin is really good at the wordplay.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned movies. We've mentioned List App a few times, and I feel like we should dig into that because my next question would be related to, and maybe by means of example, we can get into List App. I was going to ask you, for screenwriters, what would your curriculum look like? And you put up a list recently, and maybe you can explain the app as well, but you put up a list of some of your favorite movies. So you had Adaptation, you had Naked Gun down towards the bottom, and
bottom of the top five, though.
Yeah, it's the top five.
It was Adaptation, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Pulp Fiction, Casablanca, The Naked Gun. This is just personal,
right.
You know, just if I were really going to die tomorrow and they said you could play a couple, I'm not trying to impress anybody. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's just, it's not film history. It's just me.
Now, would those films correspond to the five screenplays that you would suggest people read if you were signing them?
Yeah, probably. Probably the writing is front and center for all of them. Now adaptation is brilliant because it breaks all the rules and comments on all the rules. So maybe I wouldn't teach that first. That's sort of like,
also if anybody says I want to be a writer, at least for me,
yeah,
I would say watch that movie.
Yeah. I'll talk you out of it.
Yeah. Just like, oh, I should really use a donut. God, I'm so hungry. Yeah. You know, like
you know, I guess all of these movies break the form, and maybe that's why, you know, Casablanca probably, I don't know enough about film history, but it probably broke the form. Now it is the form. So maybe I would, you know, but there are weird things in that. Pulp Fiction obviously completely breaks the form chronologically. Ferris Bueller, he narrates the movie to camera. The Naked Gun is just, they'll do anything for a laugh. You know, I guess that's kind of formal in a way. Adaptation, you know, completely commenting on itself. Maybe I think one lesson in all of that is, you know, it's not about the rules. It's about you and the audience, anything that you do.
So this is maybe out of left field a little bit. Do you like, have you seen Memento?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy that movie?
I thought it was okay.
So when I saw it, I really enjoyed it. But that, a lot of people hold that up as an example of a movie that broke the rules where it didn't work. It was trying too hard to break the rules or something like that.
I think it's a great, if I were him, if I were Nolan, I would, and that was my first big movie, I'd be very proud that I got everyone's attention. It's extremely clever as an idea. And if that's enough to give you pleasure watching it, or if that's enough to get your attention to watch it and then you get pleasure watching it, I agree. The premise is fantastically clever. I just wasn't personally especially moved watching the story. And, he's so big, it won't matter if I criticize him, but I have a real problem with the Chris Nolan worship in cinema. I think that's a screenplay. That's a writer I would never teach if I were teaching screenwriting.
Why is
that? Says the guy who's never written a screenplay. Because a movie should be a pleasurable experience. That is my one sentence answer. And I find his movies cold and formal. And I find his demeanor as a public director cold and formal. And please don't make this a headline of your podcast. No, but if someone headline. Listens all the way here, they can see it. Everyone has opinions. But I find his movies completely unpleasurable.
Exclusive to TMZ.
Yeah, and I feel that the formality has conned people into reverence, when in fact no one was smiling at any of these Batman movies that everyone gave such acclaim to, and no one was smiling at Inception, and no one understood Interstellar. I am a well-educated guy. I have a real interest in science. I write screen stories for a living, and I could not follow this. So who is following this? You know, a movie should be entertaining you and inviting you in. So that's a screenwriter I would not teach.
Got it. How did you get into tech and why tech?
I find tech, and again, this is sort of the formal rules of anything. First of all, tech is the best field at being the first to tell you that there are no rules. It's about what you make and how people respond to it, which I really love. And I think tech is leading the way for entertainment. And you realize, oh, everything is about, you know, very soon on the Apple TV, you'll be able to say the MIDI project and you won't have any idea what network it's on. It's all about whether Mindy Kaling, full disclosure, a good friend of mine, it's all about whether Mindy Kaling has made a good show, gotten the budget, gotten the cast, convinced them to do it. That's a big deal. And made it well, that's a very big deal, and gotten enough publicity for it that you are curious about it, but that's it. And there has been a lot of bullshit in terms of what night is it on and what's the competition like and how is it, you know, and who picked it up and why and who funded it and how much do they get and is it going to make syndication? And that noise has nothing to do with the product and the audience. And I think tech is leading the way in removing that. And I think tech is really, the reason I've always been drawn to it and always pitched every idea I ever had in tech to my friends in tech is because it seemed like a utopian version of you have an idea and you see if it's a good idea. You know, just like with stand up, just like with writing scenes for The Office, I think this is a great idea, but I won't know until it goes to the set and it succeeds or fails, or I bring it on stage and no one laughs or everyone does laugh. That to me is the biggest pleasure, is having an idea and seeing if you're right. And so tech seemed to me, you could have a huge idea and it could be right. Whereas in other fields, a huge idea, you need to be at a huge scale to even try it out. So that's why I always had, like, you know, that's why I met Blake Ross, because in 2006 or seven, you know, I had a friend, Charlie Cheever, who worked at Facebook.
Sure.
And I said, can I see Facebook? You know, can I have a tour? I would cultivate these friendships, and these guys, to me, that was, I think, what a lot of people looked at show business in the world I was in and thought, that's so creative. I would look at this world and think, wow, you can have an idea, and then if it works, it works. That's so beautiful. And of course, like everything, it turns out to be way more complicated.
Yeah.
But I think less complicated than other fields.
And less complicated from the standpoint of testing ideas, right? Because you have cheaper and cheaper rentable infrastructure, whether it's Amazon Web Services or otherwise. You have a global talent market where you can use people remotely or locally or in some distributed fashion, like Automattic, which I advise, you know, the guys who do WordPress.com and whatnot. I mean, they have 400 plus people who are all distributed. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Kickstarters and other means of funding that weren't available 5-10 years ago. So
if you had an idea for a store 20 years ago, that's, you really put your whole life on hold to pursue that, a compromise of that idea for a store.
Yep.
And now you can make that store.
Yeah, you can do it in an afternoon and then see how it goes. So can you describe then what it is that you're working on right now?
So this is, I've tried to get you on, and I know we'll get you on when we have the Android. This is the List app, and it's as simple as it sounds. It's li.st is our domain. So eventually when we have web, we'll probably just want to be known as List. But it's really that simple, and we aim to be that universal, just a place for lists socially. So that my original idea was, we all have these lists in our phones, in our notebooks, in our minds of what are the good restaurants in LA, et cetera. I wish I could see those lists on the phones or whatever of the people I care about, or occasionally a celebrity or a publication that I would turn to for this type of thing. And I wanted a place. It seemed so simple to me. Why hasn't it been done? I thought, a place where you could put these lists and everyone would put them, and then you could search them and read them. And that is essentially what we built. So in this case, yeah, like I think I'm right. Like, you know, I'm not saying I'm a genius or anything at all. It seemed like this was something worth testing. And if you do it right and someone shows you an idea and you say, oh, not that, but yes, that. And like anything else, the most important thing is who you partner with. And so I knew I didn't know this field, and I hired a company to make screenshots, because everyone I pitched this to treated me the way I would treat them. If a tech person pitched me a good idea for a TV show, I'd say, that sounds like a good idea. I don't think you understand what it takes to, do you have a director? Do you have funding? Do you have a cast? Do you know how to do a rewrite? You know, no, it's just an idea. Shouldn't someone make, you know? So that's how they treated me. And I thought, well, I need to show that I'm serious and that it would be good. So I asked friend after friend, do you know anyone who could make mock-ups for me? So I hired this great company called Two Toasters.
Two Toasters in New York.
Yeah. And apparently it's named after, coincidentally, an office reference where Stanley ends up with two toasters because he bought one for Phyllis's wedding. But I didn't know that when I met, I didn't even remember the reference when I met them. So I drew up I'm not a good artist, but I drew very simple. You know, again, this is not anything innovative. I drew up what a list would look like, very similar to Twitter, to Instagram, to Tumblr, you know, a very, you know, vertical feed of lists and how you'd search for them and how you'd add a suggestion to someone else's and how you'd compose. And I asked, can you make, sort of a nice mock-up of each of these main screens? So I paid them to make them. And then I would walk around and I'd tell people the idea and they'd say, yeah, it sounds good. I'd show them and they would try to tap. And they couldn't because it was just a mock-up. And that's how I knew, okay, they want to be using this. I showed them that I'm serious. They know what it feels like to want to see the next screen. And I showed, then the guy at Two Toasters, Simon, said, I host a tech breakfast in New York once a month. I was going to be in town for that tech breakfast. So I went to it, talked to everyone. I'd say about 49% of the people were way too nice to me because I was a celebrity. About 49% of the people were way too hard on me because I was a celebrity and what am I doing here? Then there was like one guy, who took me seriously, who met me at my level and said, I like it for these reasons. I think these are my concerns. And, you know, and his name was Matt Whitheiler and he was a VC at Flybridge, which doesn't do this kind of thing generally, but he was interested. So I asked if I could have lunch with him. I almost canceled. I was hungover. I'm like, what am I doing? I'm here like to do press for a TV show. And why am I pursuing this crazy tech thing? And like everyone wants to do a startup. I almost canceled, but I didn't. I show up to meet him and he says, I know the co-founder for you. I don't think you can get him, but it's worth a try. I've been trying to convince this guy to leave his job forever. But I think he might like this because he's done stuff like this before. And his name was Dev Flaherty. He ran product at Fab. He had previously worked for a sort of a map, based travel startup. And the original idea for this was travel lists, of course, would be big. So I said, let me try. I was leaving the next day. I emailed Dev, had dinner with him at, the Ace Hotel in New York, the Breslin. And we sat down
lots
right
of
away.
Fatty food.
Yeah. Right away. I was like, I'm doing with this guy. Or I'm not doing it. You know, we wore the exact same watch, an IWC Pilot. So like a nice, simple watch with great design, great classic design. We ordered a bullet bourbon, each of us. So we have the same taste, you know, and just like Matt Whitheiler, he was hard on the idea and respected the idea, asking all the right questions. And he could talk and his wife was a television writer and he was interested in what I was interested in and he was, tellingly, he was a Parks and Recreation fan, but not an Office fan. So he liked the kinds of things I liked, but he was not impressed by me, my celebrity. He heard I was somebody, but you know, he didn't care. He cared about Ron Swanson. So, you know, he was like adjacent. It was the perfect match. And, he said, Lena, let me think about it. Let me think about it. And then his wife kept getting up for jobs in, Hallie Gross is a fantastic writer. I think she's a fantastic writer, fantastic talker and thinker, and she's on great shows. So I assume she's a great writer. So she kept getting more and more attention in LA. And then she was up for this huge writing job in LA on an HBO show. And no one was rooting for that job harder than me. I'm praying that Hallie gets hired because I know if Dev moves to LA, I'm sure he'll do this. And sure enough, she got the job and he finally committed to doing this. And, you know, he's really been leading sort of the overall, you know, why I think this is so good is because of Dev. I have a lot to do with the community. I obviously have a lot to do with the conception. And I argue for all my taste all the time, but 90%+ of the time, Dev has already arrived there, and added more things that I should have thought of.
What are some of the more popular lists that have popped up?
Well, I can look at the trending lists right now.
And I'll mention one to people.
Yeah.
And just because I found this actually very, very cool and helpful, which was a list which you put on Twitter or retweeted, I think. It was Cheryl Strayed, and writer of yep. Wild, which was made into a movie. And she put out a list of writing prompts. So assignments, or I think they were more sentences or questions that you could use for writing exercises. And what is your Twitter handle?
At BJ Novak.
So very simple, at BJ Novak. So download the app and also follow BJ on Twitter because he highlights also quite a few different lists. But that list in and of itself.
Yeah, that was great. And she also did a list that was very moving which is objects found in my mother's car at the moment of her death, or the time of her death. You know, just like a pen, you know, a lipstick, tickets to this play. I don't remember exactly what it was. It was, but I remember being just so stunned by the simplicity of that power in list form. And, you know, there's a lot of writers on it, so that, you know, there's a literary thing, but I'm looking here, you know, it's a mix of publications doing lists, celebrities doing lists, and of course, mostly just regular folks, but trending right now. The Washington Post made a list of the things Donald Trump has called on America to boycott. He's called for a lot of boycotts over the years. It's very interesting, including the company that makes his clothing line, which he didn't realize. Vox made a list, what NASA picked to explain our world to aliens. So what they put on Voyager 1 and 2. Just, you know, a cool list. A girl named Jenna Martin, I know, made a list, favorite Howard Stern interviews. And that's an open list. So you can make a suggestion on that list. And if she likes it, she double taps it.
What are the top on the Howard Stern list?
Howard Stern interviews, Lady Gaga, Bill Hader, Billy Joel, which was a great one. I heard that one. Jonah Hill, Jerry Seinfeld, great interviewer. James Taylor, I did not know that. Although I've seen him be dark and funny. Chris Martin, apparently. So, you know, some of them are very helpful recommendations, a lot of books lists.
And some of them are very funny. Now, correct me if I have a faulty memory here, but I remember we were chatting on the phone a few months ago, and was it Lena Dunham who had dead people I'd have sex with? Am I making that up?
Yes, she did. And I'm looking right now. Anthony Bourdain made one that I thought was really funny.
Oh, this was, what was that? Four spy novels, three written by spies, one by a non-spy?
Yeah, he did that. He's a big reader and writer, obviously. His most recent one is called Hotel Slut. That's me. And, you know, it's very much his writing style, but it's the hotels that he will stay. He will make an excuse to go to that town if he can stay in the following hotels, including one in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, Chateau Marmont here in L.A., the Raleigh in Miami. So his lists are great.
Anything in New York?
Let me see what his New York choice is.
I'm headed to New York shortly, so maybe I'll try.
There's a lot of lists of like New York hotels. But I, you know, and there's also a list of, if you ever stay at the Bowery, which mm-hmm. is my favorite hotel there.
Bowery's great.
There's two people at least have made lists of the best rooms at the Bowery.
cool. You know,
1403 has this and 1401 has that.
Oh, that's very useful.
Very useful.
So I tried to stay at the Bowery. They were sold out for this upcoming trip.
So it's very useful and also, you know, very creative, and there's great people behind it.
For someone who downloads the app, what would you suggest to get them a very good taste of the types of content? What would you suggest they do?
I would suggest just, it's a very quick sign up flow. Just sign up and there's a recommended follow menu, and you can, they'll take you to that screen automatically. But one of the things you can do is you can hit follow all. It's our top like 100 diverse accounts. So I'll read them right now. Not all 100, but you know, the first batch: Lena Dunham, Mindy Kaling, The New York Times, Jimmy Fallon, The Onion, Anthony Bourdain, The New Yorker, CNN, Andy Cohen, Vogue, Snoop, Cheryl Strayed, Rachel Ray, you know, People. Not everyone's John Mayer, Wired, TED Talks. Not everyone's gonna, you know, like all of these, but then just unfollow, because it will give you a real, you know, assortment. And there's a lot of, you know, civilians on there too, just people that are like making, you know, crazy personal or advice lists. And so it's a real, I would just say sign up, hit recommended, hit follow all recommended, and just see what you like.
Very cool. Do you have, as we have a plane zooming overhead, do you have a little bit more time for some rapid fire questions?
Yeah, sure.
All right, cool. So we're going to shift gears just a little bit. Successful. When you hear the word successful, who's the first person who comes to mind and why?
Shakespeare.
Why?
Because he made things that were both moving and permanent and popular.
What was your...
Both three things. Shows you how far I am from that.
What was your thesis on? Did you write a senior thesis?
Whoa, you did your homework. Yeah, I did one on... mine was on... It's very specific. In the films of Hamlet, how they treat the line to be or not to be. Because that line already has a lot of mystery within the play, exactly what it means. But then you add all the culture. Like if you pay to see a movie of Hamlet, like you're waiting for it to be or not to be the whole time. So how do the cultural expectations affect the interpretation of that line?
Got it. Yeah, the bard. I mean, it's there are a lot of people who make me want to cry into a pillow. But as a writer who's trying to improve, that's certainly way up at the top of the list. What book or books do you give most often as gifts?
There's a book called The Oxford Book of Aphorisms, which I love. It's just the most well-edited, like brilliant one-liners from history. And you can spend like hours on a page. It's just, or you can just flip through it. I give that one a lot.
The Oxford
Book
of Aphorisms.
And I'm going to give Daily Rituals, that book we mentioned a lot too.
It's a great
anyone
book.
Who's creative or ambitious, you take so much solace in seeing all the different processes people just do. You know, what does Charles Dickens do every day? What did he do every day? What did Darwin do every day? What did Steve Jobs do every day? You know, it's just so reassuring to see like, everyone's got their own system.
And it also is very reassuring to see how dysfunctional so many of them are.
Yes. And depressing too.
Yeah, depressing in some cases. Great book. I actually produced the audiobook for people who want to try the audio. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?
I'd love to be great looking.
You're not a bad looking
guy. I'm not terrible looking, thank you. But, you know, I look at James Franco and he does all the things he does.
I mean,
and I'm like, man.
James Franco. Well, I mean, look at his brother. I mean, they're like.
No, I'm saying.
It's a handsome family.
Tim, if I could have whatever I wanted, I could lie and say, oh, I'd be better at empathy. No, I'd be like fucking awesome looking. And, you know, then I would like. You know, if you're James Franco, you can do anything. And people are like, well, it's pretty interesting. Like, anything. And I wish I had that extra level. I'm just answering.
No, I appreciate the honesty.
Fucking awesome.
This is good. Do you have any bad habits that you're currently working on?
Yeah, of course. I zone out. Any conversation, I'm not holding a microphone. I zone out easily. I just love daydreaming. And I think it's so indulgent in a good way to the creative process. But then you get used to that indulgence when someone else deserves your attention. So I try to be better at that.
How do you go about trying to become better at that? It's just a conscious decision not to zone out?
Good question. I don't have a process yet. Okay. I'm just always berating myself.
I do the same thing. So if you come up with anything, please let me know. Words or phrases that you overuse?
Pretty.
That's my one too.
Really?
Oh, I hate it. I started trying to fix it by saying.
Wait, do you use it as an adverb or an adjective? How do you use it?
Adverb.
See, I use it as an adjective.
Oh, okay.
But I don't mind using it.
Okay. Yeah, I say, oh, that's pretty interesting. Oh, that's pretty. Right. That's pretty. And I tried to fix it at one point by forcing myself to say fucking afterwards. So I'd say, that's pretty fucking interesting.
Yeah,
that's
good.
Fucking smart. And eventually it short circuited for a while. It's definitely.
I overuse like, which is so embarrassing because it's not a very masculine word to overuse, but I do.
Like as a verb or like
as an. I don't even know what it is. It's a stutter, really.
Right.
Like.
Oh,
I
see. Yeah, I see. Yeah. What do you have anything in writing, long form, let's say in a book? One of mine is, for instance, like that having been said or something.
Sure. I overwrite a lot and I need to pare it down.
Got it.
So
just
I don't
too
know
many
any
revisions.
One phrase, but no, I mean, I do stuff like that because it sounds, I don't know, it gives extra elegance to a stupid idea. And then I need to go back and be like, you know what?
Put some monkey in a suit. Right?
Yeah, it's something I learned on The Office too. If a scene should be 2 pages and it's 4 pages, it's a bad scene. It's just because you keep writing when you haven't hit it. So if it's a great scene, it might just be a 2-line exchange. I love you. I don't love you. Like, whoa, that's a scene. But if the scene is like, so I was thinking the other day, my feelings, you know, like that's not a scene.
You know, it's not working.
Yeah. So if you overwrite, it's often a sign that you have not hit it and you're still looking for it.
What is the best purchase that you've made in recent memory for less than $100?
An ice cube tray that has giant ice cubes in it. Anytime I'm at a bar and they have like a big ice cube, I feel like, oh, what? This should cost like $100. This is so nice. And then I thought, well, wait, the rubber ice cube tray shouldn't be any more expensive. It's just a different shape mold. So I go on Amazon, and sure enough, Tivolo, I think, is the company. Mm-hmm. You know, for like $7, it's six huge ice cubes. And if anyone comes over and I make them a drink, they have one huge ice cube in their glass, and it's like I have a fancy bar. Love it.
Do you have any favorite documentaries?
You know what? Do you mind if I look at the list app?
I don't mind if you look at the list app.
My favorite documentaries on the list app. I love documentaries, and
I'll throw one out. Well, I loved Man on Wire when it came out. Very uniquely put together, and the same team made a documentary subsequent to that called Project Nim, which was about a chimpanzee. I think this was in the 70s, effectively raised as a human child to see if Nim, in this case, could. I think it was. Nim Chomsky or Chimpsky, they called him. In any case, could acquire language. And just a fascinating documentary on human thought, human interaction with this chimp and so on.
On my list, Catfish. It's a cliche, but Catfish is a brilliant documentary.
I still haven't seen
it. It's brilliant. It's generation defining, and it's just become a term, but it earned that term. Brilliant movie. To Be and to Have is on my list. A beautiful, simple film about a one-room schoolhouse in France and just what happens over the course of a year. There's really little story, but it really holds your attention and gives you a spirit of a place. And if I choose one more. Oh, you know, it's a really cool one. It's called The Overnighters, and it's about the oil fields in North Dakota. Came out a couple years ago, and this pastor who has a church there, the Bakken oil fields, which is like probably bigger than the gold rush in the 1800s. It just like, now that you can frack, there's so much oil in North Dakota that a whole like culture, like you can rent like a garage in North Dakota for like $250,000. You know, it just, there's so much money there and such a rush to be close to it. And that's a really interesting
The Overnighters. Yeah. So I usually ask about morning routines, but I want to ask about, and you can feel free to answer that, but I'm so curious to dig a little bit into your powering up.
Yeah.
So how would you power up to kind of get into the zone?
I have a venti Pike Place coffee from Starbucks. I find that...
How is it made? Just black?
Yep, black. I find that brewing my own coffee at home is so unpredictable. It's like getting artisanal Tylenol. Like, I want to know what my dose is, you know? Like, you wouldn't be like, oh, I made some Tylenol for you. No, give me two Tylenol. So I want a standard dose of caffeine.
You want your standard, like, loading dose of caffeine. Yeah. Got it.
So I have a venti from Starbucks.
Now, when you have it, you mean you purchase, or do you just down the thing like a shot of tequila?
I either drive to the Starbucks. No, it takes an hour because I will sometimes read the paper. The Wall Street Journal the Wall Street Journal, which I find really good, especially on weekends, or the New York Times is my favorite. And, I often read that, usually read that online and, you know, just emails, and I turn on music. I usually listen to, Morning Becomes Eclectic on KCRW.
Becomes Eclectic?
Yeah. It's this great show from 9 to 12 every weekday, commercial free, like just cool new music. I also have a list on the app of music that I work to. Mm-hmm. So, and they have a 24-hour station.
Do you have another one that you can pull from memory?
I will often do Pandora of early blues.
Early blues.
I find good to just... So, yeah, I listen to music. Or Sirius XM 35 is like indie music that I like. So you just listen to music. It's just about being in a good mood. I slowly drink that Starbucks. I sometimes take a walk around Runyon Canyon or my neighborhood. You know, text, email. If there's a book I'm kind of reading, I read a couple chapters. And then eventually I'm just like, all right, like either I'm excited by an idea or it's like 3:30 and I'm like, this powering up turned into lunch, turned into a workout, you know, and I'm like, God damn it. I cleared out my whole day and it's 3:30 and I haven't written anything. You know, then I just start looking at my files and then I finally get going. So yeah, the power up can have a happy or a sad ending.
Is there a particular time of day that you find you tend to do your best writing? For me, it's always been super late night. I don't know why that is. For synthesis, for note taking, for interviewing, I can do that whenever. But for synthesis, I've always been kind of a 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. kind of guy for whatever reason.
It's hard for me to get myself to work later in the day. So probably my most productive time is like 11 to 2. Mm-hmm. But, the creative ideas can come anytime. I never know when those are coming.
Let's see here. If people wanted to watch, besides The Office, one or two TV shows for good comedy writing, any particular recommendations?
I love this show right now called The Grinder with Rob Lowe Fred Savage. That's very, very good writing. Season 4 of Mr. Show is brilliant sketch writing.
Could you explain what you mean by sketch? I apologize.
Oh, sketch like SNL, like, you know,
Got it, got it.
I'd say those are pretty great ones.
Cool. Just a few more questions.
Yeah.
What historical figure do you most identify with?
In my hopes, Ben Franklin, because he started in comedy. And then I make a joke about this in my stand-up act. Like, he really took it to the next level. I mean, he wrote Poor Richard's Almanac and he was known as a comedy writer. And then he ended up, you know, discovering electricity and having his face on Money. Like, that is really, and he remained like a witty, guy. So my hope is that I could do some shadow where I can have, ambitious, positive spirited ideas, but it won't be like, oh, now, like, he lost a sense of humor. Like, Ben Franklin always had a sense of humor and he wasn't ashamed to like experiment with, you know, lightning, you know?
Yeah.
Like that's really cool. But I, even in my most egotistical, I don't actually identify with him. He's just like, you know, if I'm stacking myself up. Yeah. Aspirational role figure. Model. So probably someone more, someone, I don't know, like funny and dark and like, I don't know.
For someone recognizing that no path is quite the same for people, certainly that I've met in entertainment or comedy or whatnot, from going from school to the industry of, if we could call it one industry of entertainment, let's just say you had a promising high school senior.
Yeah.
Who's a gifted writer. And they think they want to be in comedy writing. What advice would you give them?
A bunch of things. One piece of advice that I stand by that I've given to a bunch of people is there's really think of it as two things. You need to get people's attention and you need to be able to back it up. So this is especially for getting, I feel like most people who want to get into comedy, what they want to do these days is get a staff job on a TV comedy show. So to do that, you need think like the person hiring you. You're going to want, if you were given your own show, you'd panic. This is my one big shot. It's got to be hilarious. You'd hire your most loyal, funniest friends first. Then you'd ask around, who worked on, my favorite shows, who's the best person, and those names would come to you through an agent or something. And then you'd like anyone that you saw or heard, or you were at a stand-up show and this guy was hilarious, or someone sent you this internet video, or, you just don't know, or you'd ask around and someone would send you something. So the first thing is get their attention. That means, could mean be friends with somebody or have collaborated with somebody. Another thing is you might want to make something. For me, it was stand-up, but I don't know what it is for anyone else. It could be, probably some internet video. I feel like that's the best way you can be completely wild and get seen, but make something truly great. That's could be anything, absolutely anything. Then once you have someone's attention, they're going to want to be sure that they're not taking a crazy bet on some kid who made some funny video who then gets in a writer's room and doesn't know what to do. So that generally means have a spec script, which is a script that could be for a TV show. So you write an episode of The Office or The Simpsons or whatever, just to show that if you were on that staff, you'd be able to know the voices, you'd know how to format it, you'd know how to craft a story, you can write hard jokes. So have, you know, a spec script, and it'll probably take you a few to get a really good one, but back it up and get their attention. Now that's for anyone starting out. I don't know if I'd advise a high school senior to go right into TV writing. So this advice is probably more for someone who just graduated college or someone, whatever stage of life, they're just ready to start this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're really going to go to college, I'd say, you know, stay funny, like, be around funny people, come up with funny ideas, make your friends laugh.
Be mischievous.
Yeah, be mischievous.
Now you are, am I making this up, 30, let me say this, 36. What advice would you give your 30-year-old self, and where were you, what were you doing at 30?
At 30, I was on The Office. I wish I had told myself on The Office, and this might be specific to me. The whole time I was on The Office, I thought, well, this is my best shot at whatever I'd ever want to do. So I better not waste a second. I better write a screenplay. I better, you know, make a avant-garde film. I better get cast in something. I better do my big thing while I'm still in The Office, because I don't want to be that guy who used to be on The Office. But I didn't have time. I had two jobs on The Office. Either one of them should take up your focus.
Now at one point you had three, right? I mean, you was writer, producer, actor?
Well, producer tends to just be high level writer.
Got it.
So I take that, that was the same job. But you know, it's important. It means the writing is really, for the whole show, is part of your responsibility. So I wish I could tell, and now people ask me, what was it like working in The Office? Was it so much fun? Were you laughing all the time? Yeah, but I have to admit that's buried under, I was so anxious and always trying to write some extra thing on the side that I never finished and never had time for. And I really didn't just enjoy this incredible once in a lifetime thing. And you know, as soon as The Office ended, I was talented enough to write a book, and I'm proud of the book. And I made the app, and I worked really hard, and I was able to pull it off. Like, you know, if you can do it, you can do it. It's, you're not really on someone else's schedule ever. And you know, I also tell people all the time, like, if Will Smith isn't in a movie for 3 years, you're not walking around saying, "Where's Will Smith?" No one's paying attention to anybody else at all. You think everyone is, but they're not. So take as long as you want if you're talented. It's not really, you know, you'll get their attention again if you have reason to. And so I do wish I had told myself back then, like, this is very, very special. Like, own it, be in it, enjoy it. Instead of, you know, being so nervous and, you know, all for nothing. None of the things I tried to do on the side of The Office ever got anywhere because I just didn't have time.
I think that's good advice for a lot of people in a lot of places. That was the advice also that Stephen King gave to Neil Gaiman, one of my favorite fiction writers.
What was the advice?
Well, he said, enjoy it. Because Neil was sitting at, I think it was a book signing for Sandman, which was just this incredible canon of work that redefined what was possible in sort of the graphic novel genre.
Yeah, comic book I know world. Of that book.
Just incredible. And he's used that, of course, as a stepping stone to write novels and that have been turned into movies and so on. But he was sitting there with this huge line of people, as I remember it, and he said, enjoy this. Mm-hmm. And that's my laptop sliding, but he didn't. He had a lot of trouble enjoying it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a constant battle. Well, I don't want to take up any more of your time. This has been a blast.
Oh, it's been so great.
It's getting dark and probably time for some food. Where can people find you and what you're up to online? Where are the best places to go?
I think the best place is the List app, because that's where I am. So I would say download the List app on the App Store, or it'll be on Android and web soon. And that's just three words, the List app, or go to li.st. And my profile there is all my favorites and ideas and thoughts on this and that. I'm also on Twitter.
At BJ Novak.
At BJ Novak.
Awesome.
And that's me on the List app too.
Cool. Well, this has been great fun. Maybe we'll do a round two sometime. And thanks so much again. I really appreciate it.
So cool.
And to everybody listening, you can find the show notes, links to all the books, shows, apps, et cetera, that were mentioned at 4hourworkweek.com/podcast, or you can just go to 4hourworkweek.com and click on podcast. It has show notes for this episode and every other episode. And as always, until next time, thank you for listening.
Hey guys, this is Tim again. Just a few more things before you take off. Number one, this is 5 Bullet Friday. Do you want to get a short email from me? Would you enjoy getting a short email from me every Friday that provides a little morsel of fun before the weekend? And 5 Bullet Friday is a very short email where I share the coolest things I've found or that I've been pondering over the week. That could include favorite new albums that I've discovered. It could include gizmos and gadgets and all sorts of weird shit that I've somehow dug up in the world of the esoteric as I do. It could include favorite articles that I've read and that I've shared with my close friends, for instance. And it's very short. It's just a little tiny bite of goodness before you head off for the weekend. So if you want to receive that, check it out. Just go to 4hourworkweek.com. That's 4hourworkweek.com, all spelled out, and just drop in your email and you will get the very next one. And if you sign up, I hope you enjoy it.